There were a couple of thoughts that occurred to me after our discussion last evening about I didn't gauge the topic accurately. I thought the discussion would be on Thomas Merton. We didn't have very much time to discuss anything, but there were no questions about Thomas Merton. The questions were about world religions, and I thought that was for me that was kind of a side issue. It was one of the things Merton was interested in, but I didn't know that was our topic last night. But that's all right. So I wasn't quite as warm on that subject as I was on Thomas Merton. But I wish last night I thought of a story that I thought of afterwards. Oftentimes that happens. You get your best insight on a subject after the time has passed, and you wonder why in the world didn't you think of that when it was the right time to think about it or think of it. And this is a story that comes out of some kind of rabbinic Jewish tradition, and it's told by it's been told so many times that it has different various characters. Sometimes it's a story of the rabbi of Krakow. Sometimes it's a story of old Isaac. And I guess this time I'll tell it as the story of old Isaac, who lived in a Eastern European country at least a century ago. It's at least 100 years old, this story. It's probably older than that. But the story goes that this man, Isaac, poor Isaac, had the same dream night after night, at least three nights in a row, that he should travel to the capital city of his country, and go to the place where the king, to the king's castle, and he was to appear at the door or the gate of the king's castle, and all he had to do was to appear there, and when he appeared there, he would be given this great treasure. The great treasure would be handed over to him, or made available to him if he would appear at the gate of the king's palace, castle or palace, either way, castle or palace. He wasn't of a temperament to be guided by dreams, but the dream was recurrent, three times in a row. So he decided he would follow its guidance. So it took this walk. He didn't have a car, but before cars were manufactured, and it took him several days to travel from his small town to the capital city of the kingdom. But then when he got there, he was a little bit embarrassed because nothing happened. He appeared at the gates of the king's castle, palace, but nothing occurred. And he didn't know what to do. There were guards there, and he knew that the guards noticed him. So he thought that the best thing for him to do would be to walk around the palace, castle grounds for a while, and then reappear at the same point. And he did that one time, came back, stood around the gate of the king's castle. Still nothing happened. So he thought he'd do it another time, and this time walk slowly, so that more time would elapse. So he walked, circled the whole thing, and I don't know how many times he did that, but he must have done it several times. And then he came back, and he stood there. And by that time, the guards had been watching him, because that's rather strange behavior to, like if somebody did that at the White House, he would be noticed. And he was noticed for doing this, for standing there at the gate, circling the castle. But anyway, one of the guards asked him who he was, and he said, I'm embarrassed. He said, I'm only here because I had a dream. And he was sort of poo-pooing this dream and kind of apologizing for that sort of behavior. So the guard asked him about the dream, and he told the guard that he'd had this dream night after night, that if he were to appear at the gate of the king's castle or palace, that he would be given this fine treasure, this great, great treasure. And he said, but it's clear to me that this hasn't happened, so I won't cause you any trouble. I'll simply go home. He said all this to the guard. Well, the guard said he didn't find that so strange. He said he'd been having the same dream night after night, that there was this poor man out in some city out in the outlying kingdom who had a treasure that he didn't know about, which was under the floorboard in his parlor, about 2 paces behind the stove. And the guard just said that to poor old Isaac. Well, poor Isaac, put 2 and 2 together, 1 and 1 together, I guess, and went back home again. And when he got home, he measured off 2 paces behind the stove in his parlor and lifted up the floorboards, the boards of the floor, and looked down there, and there was that great treasure right in his own house. And he didn't know that until the guard had told him about this dream. So he went all the way back home and found the treasure right there at home. Now, that's kind of the end of that story, but there's a moral to the story. And I first came onto the story in a book by a historian of religion, Mircea Eliade, who said he got the story from a man named Neumann, who was a kind of Jungian-oriented historian of religion, psychologist of religion. And the story is told by Eliade to illustrate what happens to people when they encounter another religion. Now that's one application. That's not the application that was made the first time the story was told in the rabbinic context. But Eliade makes that application. That oftentimes, what will happen is that the journey into the other country, into some distant region, will only demonstrate to you and that the truth was right there at home, very, very close at hand, but you didn't know it was there. And the journey is necessary in order to make that fact accessible to you. And then Eliade adds that it often requires an encounter with another person of another culture, or he calls it the stranger, like the guard in the story, the stranger who will help you understand what was there all the time. Now, I don't like that story in some ways, because there's too easy an application of it that I don't think I would agree with, and that's the kind of self-satisfied application that you often hear that the people will say, well, there's nothing in Hinduism that isn't already in Christianity, and then you can say, well, then there's no reason to pay any attention to Hinduism or Buddhism or any other religion because we had it all anyway. I don't think it quite means that. I think the story means that there are so many kind of aspects of the Christian faith that remain hidden. The truths remain hidden until one is trained to look for these things with other eyes. And the other eyes become available only when you can sort of get outside the thing and look at it from a fresh perspective. But but on the other hand, there is some comfort in a story like that because, and I like to tell it, because I it takes some of the terror out of thinking about religions other than Christianity. Some of the fright and the scare. I don't think we're dealing here with just really simple matters. At the same time, I don't think that exposure to another religion necessarily or even predictably or probably violates one's attachment to his own. I think it probably works the other way, that you become more indebted to your own tradition because it's your own, and it isn't just a set of ideas and beliefs and things, but it has to do with your ethnicity, your family history, your cultural, geographical orientation, just all of so many, many things that become a part of who you are. Well, I wish I thought of that story last night because I think would have been the proper time to tell it. Now, what I'd like to do today is something a little different. I've been in the hours that I've been given here, for which I'm very grateful. I've been talking about a certain shift that has been occurring in, I think, contemporary religious consciousness, and I've been looking at it from several different points of view. And what I'd like to do today, in a few minutes, is to say something about to be something less of a school teacher than I've been up through these times. And just do a little bit of, if you can take it, to tell a few things about my own. We'll start out with a story that comes from my own Sunday school training and background, and then I'd like to say something about how I myself, as a individual Lutheran Christian, became interested in a topic like mysticism. Why it fits in the own kind of in my own the perspective that I'm developing. So I'd like to begin with a reference to Mrs. Lundeen. I don't think any of you know Mrs. Lundeen, but you've known Mrs. There's a Mrs. Lundeen sitting here, but all of you have a kind of Mrs. Lundeen in your background. And Mrs. Lundeen was the first Sunday school teacher that I can remember, and I think I was about 7 at the time. I guess there were others before that, but she was really she had a formative, we'd say nowadays, a formative influence on my, you know, upbringing. And what I remember most about Mrs. Lundeen was a certain very crucial Sunday morning when she began this session that we had. This was Augustana Lutheran Church in Omaha, and we met around down in a kind of a boiler room, and they were just all boys in this class. And she started out this class by with the question, boys, how many times have you sinned this week? And I mean, just to tell that now, I can recall the force of that question. How many times have you sinned this week? And I was thinking that I didn't really want to get into that one even then. But I thought if you could say like 3 or 4 times, that would be enough. I mean, that would show that that you took sinning seriously. If you said you hadn't sinned at all, then you everybody know that's a lie. But if you said too many times, then you'd probably have to. You'd have to tell about all the things you've done that week. And I just wanted to take the easy way and say 3 or 4. And then I thought the other way to proceed, and this is, I'm not making this up, this is conscious, was to look at my cousin, a fellow named Kenny Olson. Well, I thought was a little bolder than I was, and had probably sinned more often, just because he had more courage, I think. And if we get Mrs. Lundeen to ask Kenny Olson to answer first, then I could just subtract 1, and still the focus would be on him and not on me. Like if he said 7, I could say 6, or 4, I could say 3, and then she'd talk to Kenny about his problems, and not so much to me. Well, I don't know quite how many numbers we gave there, but we were all kind of dealing with numbers less than 10. And it was just very, very clear that Mrs. Lundeen was not pleased with those answers. We didn't understand the nature of sinning, because she kept saying many more times than that. And if some of you, we were only 7 years old, and I don't know how high we can count. But it got out of bounds after a while. You start thinking like 15 sins in 1 week. That's a tremendous number. And so then finally we had to ask her. She kept saying many more times than that, always many more times than that. I suppose if you said 50, she'd say many more times than that. So we said, we asked her, how many times have we sinned this week, Mrs. Lundeen, if she was going to tell us. And her answer to that was, 100 times a minute. Gee. At the time, I remember thinking, how could you ever, you know, be that clever to do it that many times? They have to be short ones, and 100 times a minute. But she said that the one reason you could do it 100 times a minute is because you repeat the same thing. It wouldn't be 100 new ones or 100 original sins per minute. But you repeat this. Well, I look back on that. I think that was probably maybe fairly good pedagogy. It misled us, I think, regarding the nature of sin. But what she was trying to do, I think, was to illustrate that we sin by nature, that we are sinful by nature. And I think she was, that's what she wanted us to know, that if it's our nature to sin, that we sin all the time, you know, 100 times a minute. I suppose you could even say 200 times a minute, or maybe 60 times a minute would be close. I don't know. But, she was playing numbers there, playing numbers games with something that really doesn't fit so well into numbers. Well, I start out with that today because that was my early conception of the Christian life, that it had to do. I'm gonna close the door. Okay. It had to do with sin. To be involved in going to church and being a Christian was to the central subject there was sin. And that's what we heard about all the time, sin and guilt and forgiveness. And I'm walking a narrow line here, I realize, because I want to say both, and I want to say that that's That's part of, that's a central topic, but it's not the only topic. And that'll get me into trouble. But I still want to assert that. Well, it wasn't until sometime much after that time that I began to see things a little bit differently. And I began to see that the Christian life, or to be a Christian, is to be involved in the discussion or the problem about sinning. But there's a lot more to it than that. And I suppose that happened through maybe the most radical way that occurred was through exposure to other religious traditions and even other forms of being Christian. I'm not moving here toward any kind of Unitarianism. Somebody asked me that after the session last evening. You know, it sounds like Unitarianism and Universalism, and I wouldn't be that. And things are not tending in that direction. But just to tell this thing sort of anecdotally rather than theoretically, we were in, my family and I were in England for a while almost 10 years ago when I was studying in the University of London. And we had a lady, a young woman living with us who came to help us in a way, and she lived in Santa Barbara and had been a nun at one time, or even was a nun then, but is no longer a nun. And one of the things we used to do in the evening was to check our perspective on our home life from that. It's a good thing to do that sometimes when you're away from home, or maybe it's not so good, but it's a natural thing to do, to ask yourself all kinds of questions, like when you go back, what changes are you going to make? What things ought to be corrected, and how many of the old things that you do are you going to continue doing when you go back? It gives you a chance to make a kind of fresh start. Well, it seemed to us that during these discussions in the evening around in our home, around the kitchen table in London, that when we were talking about sort of common friends, people that she knew and that Lois and I knew, that she always had a little more gracious attitude towards some of these people than I did. I was then, and not so much now, but a little bit still, I was more critical of these people, I thought, than she was, because I was saying, I don't want to associate with some of those guys again. I mean, that's how I get in trouble when I get too close. And she was always kind of charitable, and it wasn't just because she was a nun, I don't think. She just saw things differently. So I would go away from there in the morning, going down to the British Museum, to the library, just asking myself, now how could that ever be? I mean, how could we see things so differently? And one night I said to her, it seems to me that you take this Imago Dei thing really seriously. Now, the Imago Dei thing is, you know, that man is made in the image of God, and each of us is created that way, and we retain that capacity. And so whenever we meet another person, we're not simply meeting a person qua person, but there's something of God in that person, and something of God in us, and the exchange between us occurs with that thought or awareness, reality in mind. Well, she said she did. She didn't know how you could be a Christian without taking the thought that man and woman, all of us, are made in the image of God, without taking that thought seriously. Now, I've realized at that time that I hadn't taken that thought seriously. It was a serious thought, but it wasn't central to the faith as I understood it. And she wasn't quite as strong on the sin and guilt side. We had a lot we could teach her about sin and guilt, I think, how to be original in sinning and how to think of it more often. And so, well, we went on from there. I went on from there to develop a kind of typology. And it works this way, and I think I owe you this, because some of you have been listening to me now for almost 4 hours, and I'd like for you to know where I'm coming from. And this is pretty much the point of view that I've been working from. And it goes this way, that the gospel itself is not a thought or an idea or a bunch of concepts or even truths that can be transmitted, but the gospel itself is more like energy or force or life or an energy which gives life, a reality, in other words. And I'm following the statement that Paul makes about the gospel being the power unto salvation to all who believe. I think it ought to be that way. I mean, that not only should it, could we say it ought to be that way, but it is that way, that the gospel is a living reality or a living power, and like an energy, but an energy is not quite the right word because it isn't large enough to take care of that. But there is a reality to the power of the gospel which is different from ideas and thoughts and concepts and truths and thoughts about the gospel. Now, I think most of you would agree with that. But the next step that I would make in thinking about this is to say that there are at least four kind of problem areas in human life, four areas having to do with what it is to be human and to be human in relationship with God. And all four of these areas are addressed by the gospel, and in all four of these contexts, the gospel can be expressed. That is, we can talk about the gospel in terms of all four of these things, and there are probably more than four, but four of these come to mind very quickly. And the first of these, and they also kind of correlate with certain ways of looking on the world. There's a kind of philosophical way, a juridical way, a legal way, a social or sociological way, and something more looks more like psychology, but I don't really care very much about the terminology in that respect. The first of these would be the problem that would begin this way, that as by nature, you and I lack knowledge of God. We don't have knowledge of God by nature, or if whatever knowledge of God we have is not enough to lead to our salvation. And I'm sort of postponing a decision about whether, you know, we do have some kind of instinct regarding the reality of God. I think I'm quite sure that that is the case, but it's not. Whatever knowledge of God we have is not sufficient to. It's not satisfying knowledge. We don't know God in the way that we ought to know God, simply by nature. Now that's the situation. I mean, that's the problematic with which this sequence or way of portraying the gospel begins. And if we are to have or find salvation, we need knowledge of God. Now this is something we cannot develop on our own or acquire on our own. If there is to be knowledge of God, God needs to reveal himself to us because we don't have the capacity to make God accessible in cognitive terms. So at Christmas time and other times throughout the year, we celebrate the fact that the Word has become flesh, that what was unknowable to us by nature has become knowable, and in human terms, meaning in terms which makes God accessible to us in terms that we can understand, or at least appreciate. Now, I don't think that's any side issue to Christianity. That's a central, we could say that's the crux of the faith. That for those of us, for all of us who lack knowledge of God, there was a remedy. God revealed himself to us. The Word became flesh. We beheld its glory, its majesty, and we worship that. And it's so central to the faith is that we can construe the gospel in those terms. As when we talk about this, we don't say, well, that's implication or ramification or byproduct. We say, no, we're talking about the gospel when we talk about how God became flesh and revealed himself to us. We're talking about the gospel. But that's not the gospel. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation, of which then is expressed in those terms, in God's becoming flesh. Now, I imagine there are some Christians who understand that to be the entire story. And I think you can get by understanding that to be the entire story, but it wouldn't be a kind of full Catholic appreciation of the gospel. It would be wouldn't be one-sided either, but it's not the whole thing. Because there's another account or kind of set of circumstances which registers as a problem to which the gospel is also addressed. And this is the one I referred to, the Mrs. Lundeen account, the reference to sin and guilt. And that's another story. The problem there is not the same problem as the first problem, that we lack knowledge of God. The problem in this second account is that we are guilty, that we have offended God's majesty, that we have broken the law. We understand the will of God to be just and right, and we have offended the will of God, and we stand guilty in the presence of God because, and not just because we couldn't help ourselves, because we also could help ourselves, because we willfully do those kinds of things, maybe not 100 times a minute, but repeatedly. It's our nature to be this way. And the account there is that for those of us who couldn't help ourselves in that situation, once again, the remedy was provided. A sacrifice was made on our behalf so that we don't receive the just punishment or consequences of our sin, but all of that was taken by another, by God himself, who then declares that we are set free. The price for that has been paid. You know this account as well as I do. And again, I'll say the same thing about that account that I said about the first one, that this is not a side issue to the Christian faith. You know, it's not ramification, implication, byproduct, any of those things. I suppose you could say the second thing I said about the first one too, that many, many Christians understand the faith almost exclusively in these terms, and one can do it almost exclusively in these terms and go an entire lifetime that way. But I think I would still want to say that that may not be the full Catholic appreciation of the gospel, because it's only one of the stories or one of the sets of circumstances to which the gospel is addressed. Now, in that context, you'd say the same that we said about the first one, that it's not the account that is the gospel, but the gospel is the power of God unto salvation, which then is expressed within that context. And the context is not the gospel, but the gospel applies to that particular context. Now let's see if we can go a little further. There's another account, kind of narrative situation, which is established, which is referred to when Christians refer, when they express the gospel. And this is more, I'd say, more of a sociological one, but that word kind of kills it, because it brings in the whole academic area, and we're really not talking about academics here today, I don't think. But here the situation is that the Creator inserted certain very clear and distinct purposes into creation. The creation is not isn't just kind of haphazard, or ad hoc, or accidental. But there is a kind of definite set of intentions and purposes for which the Creator created the world. And these intentions are to be fulfilled. That is, creation is moving towards something, towards some kind of fulfillment or consummation, or maturation, really. And not only is this true of creation, but our corporate life, our life in society and culture, is also understood this way according to the Christian faith, that it's meant to go somewhere, to be something, to lead to we'd say brotherhood and sisterhood. What we're talking about here is the coming of the kingdom of God, that the kingdom of God is, as we understand the faith, the kingdom of God is to be there as the sort of final culmination, the realization of the purposes which were written into the initial creation of all that is around us, the natural world, the social world, our corporate world, all of these worlds. And they're there to lead to something because there is purpose in creation, purpose inserted by the Creator. Now, we understand in the Christian faith that we cannot bring this about by ourselves. The last 20, 30 years in American history, in world history, really have simply demonstrated that. The theology of hope demonstrates that we as individuals are not able to achieve the realization of these purposes that are somehow implicit in all that is. And yet, at the same time, we have confidence someday, one glad day, that will happen, that the kingdom of this world will become the kingdom of God, that the two will become synonymous, identical. Now, when we talk, that's another scenario. When we talk that way about the coming of the kingdom of God, we're talking about the gospel. That is, we're talking about the power of God unto salvation. And we're not talking, again, I'll repeat all that I said about the other two, we're not talking about side issues, implications, ramifications, byproducts. No, we're talking about the crux of the thing. And we can also say that there are some Christians who only understand the faith or the gospel in these terms, that is, in kind of social gospel terms, or in terms with respect to the coming of the kingdom of God. And those of us who don't see it that way, we're not going to say naughty things about those who do. And we would also probably agree that one can have a living kind of grasp on the Christian faith or on the gospel in those terms without having to use the other two scenarios that I mentioned. It's possible to do that. That one can have a living kind of grasp on the Christian faith or on the gospel in those terms without having to use the other two scenarios that I mentioned. It's possible to do that. But we might also say, we might suspect that that may not be the fullest or the most Catholic way, Catholic here I suppose with a small c, the fullest way of kind of appropriating or understanding the power of God unto salvation. It wouldn't be the fullest way because it would be partial. Partial to the extent that it doesn't include the other scenarios. Now, one more, and then I'll try to draw this together. The next one that one can mention here is the one that I've already referred to with our friend with whom we had conversations in London. And it's more psychological in orientation. And it has to do with, you know, the heart as being the wasteland. It's the monastic perception regarding man's and woman's nature, that the human being was meant interiorly to commune with God, to be at one with God, to feast on God within the human self, to be in sort of contact, in meditation and contemplation, to be one with God, so that God's self and our self are in communion. Now, the problem is that the capacity for that has been broken, and cannot be recovered by our own effort, and we know that there's no way that you could do that. You can't establish communion with God by your own effort or on your own terms. And yet we understand, and as I'm speaking here, we are talking about people within the faith. We understand that there's a remedy for that, that God enters the human heart. That what we could not achieve or set in motion by ourselves does in fact happen through grace, that God comes to us and we can commune with him because God becomes interior to us. And in becoming interior to us, there is a kind of progressive reformation of the human heart, that we become what we were, more and more what we were created to be. Our disposition becomes more what it was meant to be originally. We talk about that in Lutheran circles as sanctification, perhaps. Well, now, when we talk that way about the reformation of the human heart, the kind of interior dwelling of the Spirit of God within us, we're not talking about, again, like side issues, byproducts, ramifications, all these things. We're talking about something which is really central to the faith. We're talking about the power of God unto salvation. Again, it's not the context which is the gospel, But the gospel is the power, the life-giving kind of energy, which is then fitted to that context. But when we talk about it, we talk about the gospel in those terms. Now, I think you can draw your own conclusions, because I think I did that fairly clearly up until now. But I'll work on the conclusions. I think it goes without saying that all four of these contexts ought to be retained, and there probably are more. For all four of them, one can find scriptural passages which confirm our construing the gospel in those terms. For example, in terms of knowledge of God, you can cite passages about the Word becoming flesh, dwelling among us, understanding the gospel in those terms. With respect to the problem of sin and guilt, you can cite all sorts of passages such as, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And we can talk about the gospel in those terms. Like somebody said, what is the gospel? And you had to say anything about that. You can say, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And that tells us, that expresses the gospel. The one about the kingdom of God, well, I was saying a couple of nights ago that if you remove that motif, the theme of the kingdom of God, from the New Testament, something really happens to the entire structure of the New Testament. As some say, the central motif, you know, is dropped out. And even with respect to this fourth one about the man being made in the image of God, I can refer to the first chapter of Colossians, where there's reference to that mystery that has been hidden for all these ages and then has now been made known, which is Christ in you, Christ in you, the hope of glory. Now, that's an expression of the power of God unto salvation, Christ in you, the hope of glory. I'm suggesting that all four of these have to be retained. And the Christian life depends not only upon the retention of all four of these, but also upon some kind of balance or harmony between them. But I have a further suggestion to make, and this will get us back to the subject that we just left when I began this excursus into my own way of looking at things. You can also, I think, chart contemporary trends in religion this way, because it seems to me that what we've had in the church, for as long as I know church history, is a sort of moving back from one of the back and forth between these models as ways of talking about the gospel. See, I was brought up under the model. I'll call it a model. That's all right. It's a pedagogical model. Model in very, very, very many ways, under the model of sin and guilt. That was the dominant one. And then somewhere along the way, I learned that there was another way of giving shape or placing understanding the gospel in kind of model, or, if we can take a better word, paradigm terms. There was another paradigm for understanding the gospel, and that was the one of the Imago Dei. Through exposure to the theology of hope, I learned that there was still another, and that is that the gospel has something to do with the coming of the kingdom of God, and that was distinct from the others. Now, it would be we'd be kind of foolish as human beings if we said only one and none of the others. And then there'd be all. I mean, it wouldn't be naughty to do that, or bad, but it would simply tell what kind of people we are. Furthermore, there would be all kinds of things in the New Testament that we would miss, because because our interest wouldn't be there. We wouldn't be able to perceive what is there, because we're simply looking at this from a kind of single-minded point of view. Well, I'm a little bit off the track, because my suggestion is that contemporary trends in theology or religion tend to follow that kind of pattern, that there is this kind of progressive shift from one paradigm to the next. And I think what happens is that a model or a paradigm or a story is used, and really used to the hilt. And sometimes its resources are exhausted. People become tired of it. And they can't help become tired of it, because there's very, very little new insight that can be gained from that particular model. And what happens at that point is that there's a shift to another way of viewing the gospel. And that goes for a time until almost all the resources are exhausted, and then there's another shift, and it keeps going on and on and on, and that explains to me why there's change in theology, change in the church, change in religion, because we have more than one way of conceiving the power of God unto salvation. It also says something about the power of God unto salvation. I would say this, simply, that there is no way of exhausting that power. See, the power is always greater than the models we have of understanding that power. And there is no, we cannot reduce the power to a model, or we can't take life and put it in the categories, because there's always more to that treasury or to that source of life than can ever be conceived. And that's why it would be necessary, it seemed to me, for us to develop multiple ways of looking or perceiving the power of God unto salvation. No one of them could ever do justice to the life-giving source to which it makes reference. The corollary to this is that the monastic religion has developed one of these models, and it's a model that's the fourth one that I talked about. It's a model which has become very attractive to a lot of other people these days, and that's one way that I have of approaching monastic religion and mystical religion. Well, that's all I want to say here, but if anyone wants to comment, we still have 10 minutes or so. That was all right, wasn't it?
It's all right, isn't it?
In the parable of building your house on the sand, how does that fit in with what you say?
You have to tell me. I wouldn't have thought of that.
What holds up the house?
I suppose the power of God unto salvation.
Jesus had just finished telling them the way, and then he said, "Those that listen to my word and build their lives on this are like a man with a rock. Mm-hmm. Those who do not are like the." He was talking about the gospel, and then he applied it that way. Don't you think?
Is that what you meant?
No, I'm trying to think that if he meant then, all of the things are encompassed in that rock, or if you build your house on only one of these things, mm-hmm. Could that be the same? Many things are just one of the many parts of all the things he's trying to tell us. Mm-hmm. That he has for us,
and
we can get from the gospel.
Well, I don't. I have to think more about that, and I can't talk easily about things I haven't thought through. But the one that another verse that can be applied to this way of presenting things is, "In my Father's house are many rooms." Yeah, that's not a bad one. I mean, and each room sort of has new things.
Treasures new and old.
Yeah, it's not an antique house. It's and there are many, many rooms to walk through, and but it's a house. It's still a house.
I raised the point only because you said you kind of limited your discussion to four kind of categories, mm-hmm. and I kind of thought that maybe it applied that there were all kinds of categories.
I think so.
You know, like
but I've thought about this now, that particular subject for. I guess the first time I talked about that was about a year and a half ago, and I don't know what five and six would be if you added to those four. I think there's something kind of basic to them, but I have an idea there are more, but I don't know what they are.
Well, if the gospel is energy, as you suggest, there may be many different kind of emanations of energy from the source.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe in, and may I tell this group a story? Do you believe in miracles? I want people, Reverend Arm said, don't go. I'm desperate for you.
This is a story
story that you're going to tell me.
I come nearly not coming up to this village because I had a miracle happen to me. That's why I'm here. Everyone knows in here, most of them, that I carry steel bones. Well, the day before I came up here, I had to go to a luncheon in Green Lake. Well, where I get the bus, they had built a new house, but there was this much space and deep that hadn't been filled in, and I had made it across to get the bus. But when I went to go back, I looked at this width and this depth that I had to step over to the sidewalk. Well, Ellie fell into it. But it was just like the Lord lifted me in. I didn't get hurt. I didn't have any dirt on my clothes. And a woman had seen me fall and came across the sidewalk. And I couldn't get up. I was laying in this ditch. Not a hurt, not a scratch on me. And she lifted me up and took me home. Now that was what I call a miracle. No, Onset isn't saying anything over there. But I've been sitting here, and I felt I had to tell people. I just couldn't keep it in. So if you forgive me.
No, there's no forgiveness required. He's not in his head. He agrees with that, sure.
But that, and I'm not supposed to fall, but I fell. The doctor said, don't you dare fall. But I didn't fall. I was lifted into it. Not a scratch, not a bit of dirt on my clothes, nothing.
That's a miracle.
It is a miracle, absolutely. The Lord took care of me. But I think it was worth telling.
I think that's part of the miracle, is the telling of.
So. Well, anyway, it's off my chest now. And you see, I'm 84 years old, too, you know.
Sure.
I think that's a manifestation of Christ in us, that we are individual. Like that, how does the Latin go? Magnum Dei? No, imagum.
Imago Dei, image of God.
That God heals us as individuals, not only the kingdom of God, but we all have our little miracles and our wonderful things and our thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyone else?
Yes, I think we all have miracles happen to us. After I had one of my surgeries, I was forbidden to do this. Now, mother, don't do this, and mother, don't do that. Well, you get so filled up full of that mother business that you think, oh, no, you got to do some of the things you want to do yourself. And I don't know, this particular evening, I was going to take the garbage out, and it was dark. And I managed to get out all right and put the garbage in there and closing the gate after. And so then I was coming up the step, and I can't remember whether I had brought, I still think I was on crutches that time, or perhaps not, I don't know. Maybe I had the cane. And the screen door had sort of a slammed shut at the back door. And I grabbed for it and I missed it. And I went right back down on the hard cement. And boy, did I get a bang. And I thought, well, now this is it. Now, mother, what have you done? And so, of course, when I saw my sister, well, now my daughter, she said, well, now, mother, when you pull such capers, she said, we're going to have to do something about it. But I never got hurt. I never hurt myself at all, and I thought, well, I must have done something to my skull, but I never did. I never had a pain. I never had anything. And I was almost ashamed to tell him, but Dorothy lives the nearest, and of course I told her. Well, she didn't say so much. Well, mother, why do you have to carry out the garbage that night? Well, that's one of those silly things that we all do, that we shouldn't do. And I think that must have been a miracle, because there are people that do that and they kill themselves. They die right away. And I didn't have any difficulty with my neck, although years before that, my grandson and I were traveling.
I don't think you better demonstrate that anymore, though. I think it's making her a little uneasy in the back, as you keep.
Well, anyway, I thought, well, all the toddlers, I took years ago. go?
Why don't you just talk about it and not...
My arthritis helped me.
I think you better just talk about it and not illustrate it so much. Well, this is turning into an account of miracles. I suppose if anyone else wants to tell about one, that would be appropriate.
It might be interesting to just inquire a little as to if there's anyone here who thinks that a miracle hasn't happened to you in his lifetime. Has not happened to him.
I don't suppose it'd be anybody. Or if there is, maybe we wouldn't want to raise it.
I've had lots of strange things happen for which I couldn't account, but I haven't called them miracles. I think that puts it in a special category.
Okay, can let me add just a little one thing to that. What about the dreams? Now, I started this whole thing with a reference to, it was a story, but it was a man who dreamed the same thing night after night and took off, followed the dream, and how many of you, I don't know what question to ask here, but how many of you take dreams seriously that way?
Well, I dream every night. I close my eyes, I dream. Have all my life. Yeah. As soon as I close my eyes, I dream. But I can't take them seriously.
You don't take them seriously? Do you keep track of your dreams?
Yeah. Oh, no. I said it's coming back.
I don't know if I dream if I eat too much of certain things.
Well, you should say that again, because I don't think everyone heard you.
I can almost guarantee a dream if I eat too much of certain things.
You get the same dream night after night?
Not the same one. Something scary.
Well, that may be telling you something, too.
Do you think there's importance to the dream, the same dream every
I think
night?
There is.
Do you?
Sure.
Well, that's something else.
I dream perhaps gone awakened, gone back to sleep, and then follow up on a dream. Often I've done that. Mm-hmm.
The same dream?
Same dream. Mm-hmm.
Is this part of the mysticism?
Yeah, well, I could be. I think where the tie between that, between dreaming and mysticism occurs is that mysticism opens the psyche to all sorts of new possibilities. And so does dreaming. I mean, dreaming occurs when there's one part of your consciousness that is telling something to another part, or unconscious and conscious kind of interacting. The mystical literature that I haven't been talking much about it, but just kind of talking around it here, it's just full of images, dream images and visions. I'm interested in that at the moment because there's been a lot of discussion of the process of projection among now psychologists. There's a man that everyone in the field of theology or religious studies will hear about, I think, within a decade or a decade and a half, James Hillman, who has a new book called Revisioning Psychology. And Hillman was the director of studies at the Jung Institute in Zurich. And the review on this book says that this book will have more influence, will have as much influence in the area of religion and theology as Erik Erikson's book, Young Man Luther, first published in 58. And this book was just published in 76, Revisioning Psychology. And it deals in great detail with dreams, with hallucinations, with visions, with the process of sublimation, projection. And I found the same thing now in going back and looking at medieval mystical literature, that there are visions and dreams, and there are all kinds of dreams that people didn't understand, but they wrote down anyway. And there are direct lines between dreaming and being artistic. Hildegard of Bingen, for example, couldn't chart her dreams very well, didn't record them. Well, she did in a way, but they were visions, but she drew them afterwards. And they're cosmological. I'm thinking about that a lot these days here at Holden Village, because you can really see the stars, particularly at night. And if you can't... I was thinking about that moon there, where you can see moon in the daytime as well. But in our town, you can't see the stars very often. You have to go quite a ways away because of all the lights of the city.
Many are in the same difficulty that I'm in? I dream quite frequently, but I can never remember my dream. I only know I had.
I think a lot of people are in that boat.
I think I'm short because those who are students of sleep say you rest better if you are dreaming. Mm-hmm.
But some of them are nice ones. You'd like to remember them.
Yeah. There it is.
If you get that little nap just before you get up, that seems to be the time that you wake up maybe 4 or 5 o'clock and, well, surely I'll sleep some more. Well, you do, and then you dream something like that.
Yeah.
I've dreamed, I've talked to people, my sister-in-law who lives in North Dakota, and she told me, yes, she said, well, we'll meet over in the university district and we'll go shopping. And she couldn't possibly be out here. But that happened, and it seems so real.
I started up, didn't I?
You really did. That's talk about miracles, yeah.
If you keep a pencil or tablet at your bedside and write down what your dream is, when you first wake up, sometimes it comes to you then, and 5 minutes later after you get up, it's gone.
That's right.
But if you write it down.
But this is what I remembered. Isn't that funny?
I hate to read. I hate to read. I'm always glad when I wake up sometimes.
Well, I've also been told that if you make a conscious effort to remember your dream, like if you say to yourself before you go to sleep, I want to remember what I dream, that it's easier to do it.
A word or two of what it is. When you first wake up, it'll come back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because frequently, maybe a week later, something comes to you and reminds you that you did dream that.
Yes. Because you've already done it.
I have one more question on your presentation. The fourth perspective that you mentioned was the contemplative and mm-hmm. mystical. Now, I don't really get the difference between that and the Imago Dei.
No, it's the same. I mean, I don't think it. It doesn't have to be mystical. Imago Dei is central to all of it. But mystical religion does depend, roots itself in that context. Contemplative is a more generally applicable term than mystical. Mystical I think has to do more with a kind of almost spontaneous, intuitive grasp of things. And the contemplative is, well, the contemplative can follow a pattern. Prayer would be contemplation, but prayer doesn't have to be mystical necessarily. The mystical element is much more specialized and unique, distinct. Not everyone is a mystic, but not everyone can be, I don't think. But I would think every religious person could be contemplative, and in fact, no doubt is. I mean, I don't know how you could do that without being contemplative. We notice that among our students, and it's kind of an occupational hazard in a way, that when you get really involved in religion or religious studies or theology or the spiritual life, it really gets into your consciousness so that you're doing it kind of all day long. I mean, you become self-conscious. And we notice among graduate students, I don't know if it's because they're graduate students or because they're graduate students in religious studies, but they can come into this thing with a certain amount of boldness, then they just get bombarded with stuff. And where this shows up is, one way is that they don't walk in the center of the hallway. They tend to walk toward the sides after they've been around there about a year. And we hope that we can, bring them out of that so they can come back and meet the world kind of head on. But if you meet a religious person, you find somebody who's self-conscious. It seems to me that's the way it is. Not always second-guessing oneself, but just weighing things, just thinking about things, contemplative, contemplative.
In your observation of this phenomenon among the students, do the women students dream more than the male students?
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think I've ever polled anybody on dreams. There's some things I want to say here, but it's not the thing is already over, and I don't know if I want to say it in a group. I guess I can quickly, but I've been spending a lot of time in psychology religion, looking at the life story of Sigmund Freud and also C.G. Jung. And I found that that Freud's mother died when she was 95. And Freud, all that time, lived under a certain kind of domination of his mother. And it's been suggested recently that had Freud's mother died earlier, Freud and Jung would not have been as different from each other, because Jung is very much open to feminine archetypal consciousness, and Freud is more masculine. And that's a whole subject we can't get into now, especially when the time is over. But I got into this subject because my mother had a stroke, and it was a very kind of an odd thing to be around this woman who is my mother, still my mother, and realize how different she was. In some ways, she's not my mother. I mean, she's my mother always, but she's not the same woman that she was. And at that point, the dream life, my own dream life, became so much more exciting, richer, and it made me think that there was something to this thing, that when that one has can be so dependent upon the mother figure, that there's all kinds of things that are supplied through that relationship, which when it's cut, makes other things accessible. And the way I check this, shows what kind of a crazy mind I have, I check this by reading Augustine's Confessions, because I thought to myself that something must have happened to Augustine after his mother died. Well, the odd thing is that there's no more narrative. After the first five books of the Confessions are all about his boyhood, stealing the pears and all the things he got into with his mistress, and running around there trying to decide whether to be a Platonist or a Christian and whether to be baptized. And then finally his mother dies, and there are no more events that are recorded in the Confessions. From that point on, in the next chapter, he deals first of all with memory, and then he talks about time, and talks about creation. And in some way that's a confirmation of that thought that I expressed earlier. And it has a direct relationship with the content of dreams. But that's really a different subject. Thank you.